Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Moment of Change, brought to you by On Purpose London. On Purpose develops people to take on the greatest challenge of our time, to transform our economy from profit to purpose. For this three-part mini-series, we want to look at an area we're really passionate about, the circular economy. Thinking about the future of the planet can feel bleak. It feels that we live in a throwaway society with a culture of always wanting more, a want that ultimately contributes to huge biodiversity losses, pollution, and waste. Things can get quite depressing, and sometimes it can be easy to think, am I really making a difference? Don't fret, there are many amazing organizations and individuals giving us stories of hope, stories of their work and the incredible impact they have on our world. For this three-part mini-series, we want to look at the idea of the circular economy. We have loosely based our three episodes on the Ellen MacArthur Foundation's three principles of the circular economy, which are eliminate waste and pollution, circulate products and materials, and regenerate nature. Each of the three episodes will be looking at one of these principles and how we as individuals have the power to drive change. I'm Sarah.
I'm Alice.
And I'm Matt.
In this episode, we're talking about the first principle of the circular economy, eliminate waste and pollution. I love this element as it aligns with my personal principles of tread lightly while I'm on this planet and leave no trace. Having worked in waste management, I have experienced firsthand how difficult it is to dispose of everything we create and no longer want. Working to eliminate waste and pollution takes us to where we have most impact and power. If it doesn't exist in the first place, we don't have the difficulties of disposing of it.
We are really excited to be talking to Hannah today, who joins us from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation.
Woo!
We're a huge fan of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation and the amazing work that you, Hannah, and the foundation do. You've been with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation for about a year now, and we've really just now even loved hearing about the foundation's approach to eliminating waste. As an On Purpose Fellow, you're also leading the way to systems change and supporting others to change their mindset. So thank you so much for your time today.
Woo. Thank you. What an introduction. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Cool. Okay, first question. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Ellen MacArthur Foundation?
So the foundation's mission is to accelerate the transition to a circular economy. Maybe just a bit of context for slightly younger listeners than myself that maybe aren't as familiar with our founder, Ellen. Ellen founded the foundation after becoming the first person to navigate, or the fastest person, I should say, to navigate the globe in a pretty small boat. And when she was on this journey and subsequently, she spent some time thinking about, you know, when she was on the boat, she had to be really careful about how she used resources, you know, right down to the last scrap of petrol, the last scrap of food. And she had this epiphany that the way that we use resources in the global economy shouldn't really be any different, because resources are finite. So, you know, despite being an incredible sailor and still being quite young when she sailed around the world, she kind of took a change of tack and set up the foundation. And now our work is to really, as I said, accelerate that transition and normalize the circular economy as a solutions framework for tackling some of the world's global challenges, such as climate change, pollution, and waste. In terms of like how we go about this, there's sort of three different, I guess, like prongs that we approach it from. So the first is changing business practice. So we work directly with businesses to embed circular thinking within their organization, right through from when they design their strategy through to implementation and measuring the impact. We also understand, however, that businesses on their own can only go so far. So we do also work at the policy level to try and create the enabling conditions for businesses to do better. And the last point is just around shifting mindsets. So, you know, for any kind of great cultural change, you need to have a kind of shift in how people see things. So we work to put ideas out there, share possible solutions and ideas around a circular economy to really help shift the mindsets around what our economy is and could be.
Thanks for that. Yeah, really interesting story of Ellen as well. I didn't actually know that, so thank you for sharing that. Can you explain maybe on a more personal level what the circular economy means to you?
Yeah, I think that's a difficult but really good question. I think for me, it really comes down to that idea of, materiality and material use. And it's I feel like the situation we're in our current economy is quite weird because we're using more and more resources across, multiple different sectors, but yet we're valuing it less. So I feel like the circular economy is kind of the inverse of that, in that we want to create a world where we really value the precious materials and inputs that the world offers us, and kind of leave it for the next generation. So, and I grew up in this economy, so I definitely fail on that on a daily basis. But I think that's really what it is about, just really valuing the earth and the raw materials, and making sure that we live within its boundaries. So there's a lot of overlaps, for example, with donut economics and, biomimicry 3.8 and things like that. So there's a lot of different interplays there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. So you already kind of touched on this in your previous answer, talking a little bit about policy as kind of one of the areas that Ellen MacArthur Foundation focuses on. So we want to hone in on that. How would you say kind of Ellen MacArthur Foundation view the role of policy in achieving a circular economy? Can you talk a little bit more about that? That would be really interesting.
Yeah, I think the short answer would be, I think we think it's essential for bringing about systems wide change. Obviously, the kind of the journey to how you get to and implement policy is a lot more complicated than that. But yeah, ultimately, we think it's really, really important and yeah, essential for getting to where we need to be in terms of the circular economy. What I would say is that as an organisation, we are not a lobbying organisation, so we don't lobby or advocate for very, very specific policies. But what we do is kind of, advocate for the circular economy, put out research and ideas that informs policies. Because we work with businesses, we have to work quite carefully within the sort of triangle of what we're trying to do between businesses and policymakers. And maybe a good example, just to sort of put it into practice, is our work around plastics. It's probably some of the work that we're most famous for is around trying to eliminate plastic waste. I think it was around 2016 where we published a report called New Plastics Economy that said that if we carry on the way we're going by 2050, there's going to be more plastic in the ocean than fish, which really kind of caught the attention of policymakers and also the public. Off the back of that, we launched something called the Global Commitment. It's still going, and it's been really, really successful. I can talk about that. And what it was the largest global voluntary effort on plastic waste and pollution from some of the world's largest plastic polluters. So we had over 1,000 organisations sign up to that, who invested collectively over £10 billion in trying to increase their recycled content in their plastic, eliminate waste and things like that. And that did have, a lot of success. We managed to double the recycled content that was used by signatories to the Global Commitment. We managed to create transparency amongst the different participants, because a big part of what we do is try to create sort of pre-competitive collaborations and create a bit of transparency between the businesses so that they're all on a level playing field. And ultimately avoided 2.8 million tonnes of virgin plastic per year kind of leaking out of our system. So that's all great, but obviously we took a lot of learnings from that. And we understand that from talking to businesses, there's only so much that they can do alone without having a level playing field that's created by policy. So what we're now doing and have been doing for quite a while is working on something called the Business Coalition for a Global Plastics Treaty. This is in collaboration with the WWF and the UN, and it's trying to create a plastic treaty that will create a level playing field for business and really allow a lot of acceleration in terms of eliminating plastic waste in this area. So that's kind of an example of how important policy is, but obviously the journey to how you get there and how you create meaningful policy needs to start with a groundswell of business, of media, of culture to really create that change, I think.
I loved hearing about that. Thank you so much. That's got me thinking so much about the legislation that's coming through. The EU are bringing out some legislation and saying that first generation plastics can't be used after X date in a couple of years' time or something. Sorry, I don't know the specifics, but what you're talking about really is making me think that Ellen MacArthur Foundation creates that base for system change, because if you show the companies are willing to do it, then government have no argument for saying they won't create the legislation.
Yeah.
Do you think there's that sort of systems thinking approach from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I think that's exactly what it is. I think our CEO said, and I used it in a speech once and everyone went nuts, but in a way I didn't quite understand, but we're not really a think tank, we're a do tank. So
nice.
We try and create projects that showcase it in action, but then use that to build an evidence base for policymakers. So yeah, so it's because it's complicated, right? We're trying to change the whole bloody economy, so it requires quite a lot of different actions. Yeah, so I think to give you an example of that, we wrote a report called The Growth Within in 2015, which was all about evidencing the economic case for a circular economy. And a lot of that, whilst we're not directly lobbying policymakers, a lot of that fed into the circular economy action plan for Europe, where a lot of the policies you're talking about kind of have come from. So yeah, so we're really a system change organization, definitely.
Do you find it really hard to persuade the organisations? Like, in my mind, big business is bad business. And I realise that I need to change that to work with bigger businesses more, because then you can change it. Are they very difficult to change, or are you finding more and more are coming to the table?
I think both, in a funny way. I think it is difficult to change. I was thinking about this a lot on the way here and how to articulate it. I think it's that just the systems that we've created in terms of short-term profit reporting cycles, shareholder models, there's really entrenched systems that are hard to get out of. And obviously people within organisations have specific targets and goals that they're trying to meet and trying to balance alongside kind of being a leader and leading on the circular economy. I personally feel encouraged from the people that I talk to about how much change wants to happen from within businesses and how much appetite there is. Even, you know, just the number of sort of the amount of resources that are dedicated in terms of having circular economy experts within business, having real teams dedicated to this now. It's not where it needs to be, but it's getting there, and I think there is a real willing, but it's just about creating that level playing field so that they can make the right decisions. And I'm not saying, of course, there's like bad business behavior. I mean, you just have to look at it's not maybe a relevant example, but the post office scandal to know that businesses can do bad things. But I think we try and look at it through a systems lens rather than focusing on individual action. That said, maybe this is getting into more of a coaching space, but I do think there's really a role for activists and for people that don't like big business and are kind of need to push from the outside. I was at a conference of CSOs the other day, and somebody who was a CSO said that they'd worked at a big bank, I won't mention their name, in a previous life, and was really trying to get the sustainability on the agenda of the CEO but couldn't get in the door. And then I think it was Just Stop Oil or something, did a huge protest. And then all of a sudden the CEO was willing to speak to her. So I do think there's room for everyone in the system. And I think it's important that you figure out what's the right space for you.
Nice. You've already spoken about it or mentioned it a little bit on a policy level, maybe within the UK or within the EU or kind of wider space. What themes or, I guess, trends do you see emerging and who's leading the way?
Yeah, so I think a big trend at the moment, a hot trend in the circular economy space, is a digital product passports, or DPPs as we refer to them in the sector. These are really important because they've come out of some EU legislation called ESPR, which stands for Eco Design for Sustainable Product Regulation, which is part of the Circular Economy Action Plan for Europe. And the idea behind ESPR is that it sets a sort of a wide range of requirements across a few different sectors for improving circularity. So there's going to be sort of standards set across, I think it's construction for EV batteries and textiles, around product durability, reusability, energy and resource efficiency, you know, standards on recycled content, and the ability to remanufacture and recycle is just a few of them. Now, obviously, to do this and to ensure that products can be taken apart and remade or materials can be recycled, you really need to understand where they've come from and what's in the products in the first place. A lot of companies really struggle to understand just their supply chains and where the materials and where the, I mean, you would know this working in waste management, but what's actually in the products and where's it coming from. So the idea behind digital product passports is that it will really allow you to get transparency on your supply chain, which will allow you to make better decisions in terms of design and improve the circularity. The other kind of exciting thing I think about this is it's not going to just apply to products made within the EU, but also products coming from outside the EU into the EU, because that's another sort of issue that a lot of companies face, is obviously competition from overseas markets where maybe they have different standards and things like that. So yeah, I would say DPPs, guys, watch out.
One to watch out for in 2024.
That's what I was going to say. How far off is that, do you think?
I mean, I think the legislation is coming in, you know, there's sort of different phases depending on the sector that you're talking about. But like 2024, 2025, I think a lot of this will be. And there's like loads of different companies doing stuff around this. I mean, you asked about market leader, but I think there's lots of different organisations doing stuff in this space. So it will be interesting to see who comes out on top and, you know, who's leading the way.
Yeah. Cool. I don't know if this is one for the podcast, but I am super skeptical about that because I studied a bit of supply chain management at university, and just the complexities of some of these supply chains. Yeah, I find it quite hard to believe that someone will be able to actually make them 100% traceable, especially with stuff coming out of other countries where legislation is so different. I don't know if I have a question about it, but yeah.
No, I think it's a good challenge, and I think it is a really like incredibly complicated, particularly depending on what type of product you're talking about. And I guess it'll depend on the fine print of the legislation as to how companies respond to it. But it's definitely a hot topic, and, you know, I think a step in the right direction.
Definitely.
Cool.
And I think one thing on it that is, if it applies to products sold in the EU as well as, what were the two different things you said?
So products made in the EU and products made outside of the EU, but both sold
as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's huge because like the way it's a huge market, and if it's mandatory, then yes, I agree that it is difficult and complex. But if it's mandatory, people do stuff when they have to. It's a good way to, I think it'll kickstart loads of change. So Hannah, I'm really into product design, and it feels like the start of the chain, really. Mm-hmm. Obviously kind of material sourcing and stuff like that happens, but what you ask a product to be kind of determines the rest of its life. It kind of builds on what you were saying before about the kind of digital product passport idea. So I thought it's quite a big question, but I thought I'd ask how you thought product design could help eliminate waste kind of from the beginning.
I think at the foundation we would agree with you that product design is absolutely crucial to eliminating waste. So we have three principles of the circular economy that I know you've based, you know, this series of podcasts on, but all of them we feel should be driven by design. So design is absolutely critical to ensuring a circular economy. In terms of like how, it's probably best to talk about it in terms of examples. So an example of a company I really love and we love at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation is someone called Appeal, who basically produce an edible spray that you can use to put on different fruits and vegetables. That means that you don't have to use kind of plastic packaging, unnecessary plastic packaging that ultimately ends up as waste. The other really cool thing about it is that it prolongs the life of food, because I think it's 10% of carbon emissions come from food waste or something crazy like that. So, you know, by prolonging food for longer, you're kind of hopefully eliminating food waste, making sure that people aren't wasting money as well, and that it's edible. The other one, obviously, in that space would be Knoppler, who are very, very well known, having won the Earthshot Prize, but have developed an alternative to what we call flexible packaging, which is, you know, like it's tomato sauce containers that you'd get in McDonald's or something like
liquids.
That. So Knoppler have created a kind of alternative to that, that you can put water in and drink it, or, you know, put like mustard in and then it decomposes and there's very little waste involved. So we love Knoppler, the foundation. Maybe a slightly more technical example or one that's kind of relevant to the fashion space is a company called Resortex. So Resortex have developed a thread that you can use to sew up clothes together, but that it but dissolves under heat. And what that means is that you can recover a lot more of the material when it comes to at the end of its first life, because of the way that the threads dissolve, and then obviously reuse it in other kind of fabrics. So that means you can cover 90% of the initial textile product. There's a 60 million ton reduction in CO2 emissions if it was adopted across Europe, and a 50% reduction in raw material loss using their smart stitch technology. And then I'm quite a big fan of like the built environment as a sector. I think there's loads of like really cool design ideas within there. So just a really simple design within the, or a really simple question that a lot of architects and designers are thinking about when they're looking at buildings is, do you always need to start from scratch or build a new building, or can you just build on what you have? So there's an example called the Key Quarter Tower in Sydney, which was a really, no offence, but quite basic 1970s tower block that wasn't fit for purpose anymore. They needed it to fit more people, it needed to host more services, and just generally needed an upgrade. But like from a design point of view, and it sounds like you'd know a lot more about this than me, when you're thinking about buildings, from a design brief, it can be quite constraining to refurb a building rather than just knock it down and start again. But what they did, they decided to, rather than knock it down, just to extend the northern portion and like kind of created a new extension on it. But also they designed like a first of its kind lift design within the building that meant that rather than needing 9 lift shafts, you needed 4, which meant that you created extra space within the building and you didn't need to use extra materials. So in that, they 50% of the building's resources were reused from the existing building. They saved 12,000 tons of embodied carbon, and they managed to double the building occupancy capacity. So I think there's loads of ways that design is really, really important in the circular economy. But I also think, and maybe what's not talked about is like that's the bit that makes it fun, that makes it exciting, like that's the bit that's kind of innovative and cool, because I think a lot of these conversations around the environment can be quite like, you know, doomsday miserable, but I think there's quite a lot to be inspired by if you take it, if you look at it from a sort of design thinking through a design thinking lens almost.
Definitely. And also I think like I renovated a house.
Oh,
and,
did you?
And it was one of the things that inspired me to look more into like this can't be the best way to do it.
Yeah,
it was using an existing house, obviously, but the amount of stuff that gets thrown away, and then the amount of products you're buying which are, you know, cement based or whatever, just really shocked me. And you know, the idea of a skip outside your house full of stuff that's going to landfill. But when you start looking into, well, actually what is going on out there in terms of new materials or innovative like insulation or, you know, plaster or whatever, there is so much. And yeah, that, and that's when it turns from being depressing to exciting, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the story that we need to be telling more of. And I was going to mention it when we were talking about policy, but I think that if you think about big kind of policy shifts that have happened, even whether it be around like smoking legislation or gay marriage, before that there was a big cultural shift or movement, you know, like they banned a lot of cigarette advertising, gay people were much more prevalent in sort of TV shows and the media, and I feel like we need a bit more of that to really realize the circular economy and push that policy space forward a bit more. It just needs to be that messaging and that like that inspiration needs to be become a bit more mainstream, I think.
Definitely, yeah. It definitely feels like in the UK particularly, the level of understanding and the expectation of quality in building is quite low.
Yeah.
At least that's how I feel. Whereas, maybe it's a global thing, but I think there's a potential for it to become more exciting and more accessible for everyone.
Yeah, and I think it's probably just like there's economic factors at play as well, right? You need to create the right conditions. Mm-hmm. There's a building I love in that was designed with Biomimicry 3.8, who I mentioned earlier, who have this concept that if you're building somewhere where there would have been a forest, that you should apply the same principles of that forest to that building in order to make sure that it's not just a building, but it's like sequestering carbon or it's purifying water or all of these things. They built the new Coast Guard building in Washington, and they took inspiration from a nearby river basin and the use of a beaver dam, and kind of created this stepped approach, and then planted like 8 times more trees than normal. And after they were finished, like loads of like fauna and different animals came back. But what I was going to say was what kind of made that possible was, I don't know the specifics, but there was a specific bit of legislation in Washington that made the incentive around like tax for water that incentivized them to create this kind of closed loop system. So it all kind of has to work together, I think.
Nice. Yeah, it's kind of like becomes additive rather than subtractive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I've got a little question as well, if this is a good time. So I'm working at Sustainable Ventures at the moment, who support innovations in clean tech and moving them into the sort of commercial world successfully. And some of the companies that I've seen on your website are sort of similar. They do similar things. It's just such an exciting place to be in. What is Ellen MacArthur's foundation role with regards to those? Like, do you research them? Do you give them more visibility for Knopfler and Appeal and Resortex? Like, what do you do with them in that sphere?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different things. So within our formal network, there are obviously businesses, but also NGOs and institutions. We have a kind of wider community of about 3,000 startups who we support through a digital platform, but also things like reverse pitches. So we'll get people that, you know, are responsible for funding startups to come in and pitch, how do you get money from my business? We'll also amplify what they're doing through our events and through our media and all of the different outputs. You know, we put out a lot of videos, a lot of content, so we support them through that way, yeah.
I read about those Resortex a while ago. I love that as a brand. Our textile wastage is so high, so it's so good to have that coming out.
Yeah.
Okay, Hannah, the exciting time has come. This is our last question. Thank you so much for your time again. Having spent years working in a difficult environment trying to minimise the impact of government cuts, I'm really enjoying working at Sustainable Ventures. And I really, like every day, I get to come across new and exciting clean tech that are making a positive cycle, and it's creating so much hope in me for change, whereas before I was working like the negative cycle of trying to push back change. It's making me feel really empowered, and that as an individual, I can play a part in system change. And we've discussed like the big elements of system change, but I thought I'd really like to pick your brain today for people that are listening to the podcast and understand any ideas that you've got of what listeners can do to contribute as individuals.
Yeah, in terms of your purchasing actions or just generally?
Yeah, kind of like anything that you think that like really floats your boat, really. So for me, I set myself a little fun challenge to not buy any new clothes for a year in May last year, and it's been so like embarrassingly
for
easy.
A year.
Yeah,
yeah,
love that, Alice.
I had so many clothes.
I thought you meant just for me. I was like, oh, well done. No, but for a year, okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I would find that hard. I think a little bit.
I don't know if you would once you tried it.
Yeah,
like you're like, oh, I've got loads of clothes.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah,
and Vinted is great.
Yeah, Vinted's an interesting one, isn't it?
Buy no clothes.
Oh, no clothes. Sorry, I thought you said no new clothes.
I was going to say, do you go to charity shops then?
Or no, I haven't bought anything since May 2023.
Well, I think that's quite a good pathway into talking about the circular economy. If you take kind of circular economy principles, and I don't know if you're familiar with our butterfly diagram, which basically talks about the technical cycle, which is things like metals or any products that are not made from sort of live inputs. And then you have the biological cycle, which is sort of our food and textile ecosystem. If we think about the circular economy through that lens, in terms of what you can do or your behaviours as an individual, the closest loop, as we would call it, or the way to protect value the most is just keeping things in circulation as long as possible. So I would say really valuing what you have, looking after it and keeping things in circulation, you know, using your clothes, repairing everything is really important. Then, of course, when that's not possible anymore, the sort of second new loop is like, how can you reuse it? So thinking about ways that, you know, if you're having to dispose of things or things have come to the end of their life, what's the best way to reuse it or recycle it? Recycling is actually slightly different to reuse, and we would put that as the sort of last resort. So I would say thinking about it through that lens can be helpful in terms of how you deal with your own materials that you're using. I think a personal thing for me is, you know, because I worked on purpose and now I work at Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and like we're a type, right? Like we're we're very much a tribe. And I really think a big issue is the polarisation in society and the fact that a lot of these conversations happen within certain groups of people, particularly at a time of cost of living crisis. I do this with family members. I should do it more, but I think a big thing that people can do is go out and interact and try and change the minds of people that are not already on their side. Because, you know, I go to a lot of sustainability events and a lot of it is just defining the problem, and I feel like we get it now. Like, we broadly know that what the issue is. It's more about, like, how can you talk to people, how can you bring people on side, how can you discuss solutions, and thinking about it from that mindset as well.
I really like that. So I'm thinking about what action can I do with regard to my purchasing power, and you're like, you don't even need to go that far. It can be how you communicate and how you work with others, which is obviously a core part of On Purpose as well.
Yeah.
Do you have any hacks and examples or like coaching approach that you take on with these big businesses when you're talking to them about sustainability?
In my experience, they quite like to be challenged or just to think about things in a different way. And that's kind of why they want to work with the foundation, because they want their thinking challenged and to have a different perspective on things. Like, that's kind of the value we offer. So I feel like with the organisations we work with, sometimes we're pushing an open door. Or I guess the learning from that would be people are more open to different points of view than you necessarily, or that we've kind of maybe become accustomed to think, because of the polarisation and the different sort of camps that we've sort of been forced into. So, yeah, and maybe just a bit of humility as well, and just accepting that no one has all the answers and no one's doing things perfectly, and just remaining humble. Not all heroes wear Patagonia, I would say.
It's definitely one that I'm still working on.
Bashing.
No shade on. I really like Patagonia, but
the brand smashing hero.
Please join our network.
Looking for placements currently.
Thank you for sharing that. I think there's definitely an element we've been discussing in our cohort at the moment about how we're in our silo,
yeah,
and we're like talking with the open door, as you put it. I like that analogy, and like, I can develop my understanding and ability to discuss about these if I'm having those conversations with more people. I saw someone litter the other day and I was like, what, people still do that? And
really? Yeah, I haven't seen that. Is mad.
We had one question that we thought we'd like to ask you just at the end, and that is, obviously, you're not having it so much with the people that you're working with, because you're in the joy of that positive loop.
Yeah.
But it is a big, enormous challenge, and trying to make this change, like, when there's difficulty. How do you stay positive in the face of such enormous challenges and help stay focused on the opportunity of a bright future?
Yeah, and I didn't mean to, when I say that we're pushing it and open door, that's by no way I want to minimise the challenges or the systemic issues that we are coming up against. I guess it's a bit of a double-edged sword. In some ways, I feel there's just a growing body of evidence that the current economic system isn't working. Like, if you look at commodity prices since the 70s, you know, there's so much volatility there. So I think if you look at kind of the inequality of wealth, it's just no longer working for society. So I think in some ways we're being forced into change. And if I look at what companies are doing around trying to take action towards becoming circular, I do feel like we're reaching a tipping point. And, you know, you will have done a lot of, maybe, I don't know how many sessions you will have done with Tom Riffin yet around like systems thinking, but that idea of like the tipping point, and it feels to me like we're getting there. So in some ways it's horrible, because obviously it's affecting people's daily lives and people are really suffering. But I do feel like just so many little things are showing me that we are reaching a point where we're going to have no choice but to change. And in some ways that's encouraging. And then I think this is like the worst analogy for a climate related podcast, but like, I'm really scared of flying, like terrified. So it's good. So it means I don't fly that much. But about 10 years ago, I was getting a plane from New York and there was like really, really bad turbulence. And the guy next to me was just like, but the thing is like, you can't you can't control it, so you might as well just relax. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I just relaxed. And I kind of feel like that about, obviously, like, there's only, with all of this stuff, like, you can do what you can do, but there's only so much you can control. And I think it is going to be a bumpy ride. So you just kind of have to accept that and have the faith that the plane will land in using biofuel and
no plastic.
yeah, that's a whole, like, the plastic problem with planes is really complicated because it's obviously you're flying between so many different zones. Yeah. Like, that's a really tricky challenge. But anyway, ooh. Yeah.
That's, I like that. I like that mentality. It's, yeah, like, I think it's, yeah, something we have to remind ourselves anyways in general and in life. It's like only so much you can control and you can do your best, but also, yeah, step by step and keep positive.
Yeah.
Hannah, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful chat. Thanks for coming in.
Yay.
Thank you for letting me be back in the On Purpose world for a little bit.
It's always, we love you,
always
Hannah.
Nice to visit.
Anytime.
Don't ever leave.
I think we can all agree, though. We've covered quite a lot of ground, I think, in a short time. And this is something we all care quite deeply about and could probably continue endlessly. So, but yeah, really inspiring, kind of some really inspiring examples of companies that you mentioned that I will be looking up. We'll also include some links down below in case you're interested. And a nice positive note as well about bringing together the big problems that need solving from like a policy level and then down to what you can do as an individual. And this idea of discussing and communicating openly, honestly with people, particularly outside of your bubble, I think is a really important thing to recognise. Yeah, knowing when you're kind of preaching to the converted, or maybe that there's a little note of interest someone has that you can kind of pick up on. So
yeah, and I think I didn't mention it before, but maybe within that, where possible, trying to play an active listening role, seeing it as a two-way thing rather than some kind of conversion opportunity.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Necessarily.
The opportunity for a conversation rather than, you know, no one likes being preached to. So it's always nice to have more of an engaged discussion on a level. So
But also then, right, you learn from those in other areas and then they're are quite often very valid reasons for why that is happening, and then change can enable in a more ground-rooted, effective way. Because I know that I'm normally right, but every now and then I might not be, and somebody might have a better idea, and then that creates much stronger foundation for system change.
Sure. Especially when, at the moment, when things are growing, like the economies of scale for the bad things are great. So a lot of this comes down to, you know, the what can you afford to change.
So
it's always worth kind of keeping that in mind. Anyway, thanks so much again.
Thanks, Hannah. Thank you. Bye. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to listen to others in the series. If you're interested in these topics and system change, you can follow On Purpose and subscribe to our newsletter. The On Purpose Associate Programme runs every 6 months in London, Paris and Berlin. So check out our links in the show notes to find out more. Bye.